So, good afternoon for another Neurocast at Synapse Vienna. Today we are very proud to have Michael Gödert from Cambridge. He's a basic scientist. He's doing kind of research that we as clinicians, we are very happy that they are doing it. All our Neurocasts so far have been focused on more clinical topics, and we were discussing about issues that aim directly to our patients. Now I'm very excited that we have somebody from basic science, from the very other part of the scale. He will explain us the basics of the degenerative diseases like Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease and maybe others. And he will tell us what implications this will have to our clinicians, to our clinical world. And very happy to have Dr. Dieter Volz with us as well. And we are looking forward to see your presentation, Michael. Michael is a schoolmate from me. We have been together at the school. And after graduating, Michael went to Basel, was very focused on what he was planning to do. And then after his time in Basel, he went to Cambridge, and he has been there since. Michael, please.
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me. And it's a great pleasure to see you again after all these years. So we've known each other for something like, I don't know, probably 50 years. Although I must say, I still feel about the same as I felt when we met at the time and we were going to school. So I've been here for a long time. So I've been here since 1982, and I'm working on the sort of abnormal filamentous inclusions that you find in most neurodegenerative diseases. And in the past 5 years or so, we have used a method called cryo-electron microscopy, which allows you to get high resolution structures of these filaments. And this is ongoing work, but I'll talk about basically where we are right now. So I'll give an overview of these studies of cryo-electron microscopy structures of amyloid filaments from human brain. So maybe if I start with the first slide, just see. Let's see, try this. Yep, can you see this? This is a slide showing a large number of different neurodegenerative conditions, and they account for something like 95% of all cases of late onset neurodegenerative disease, and they're grouped together here because they share the presence of abnormal filamentous inclusions in nerve cells and for some also in glial cells. Now, most cases of disease of the diseases shown here, most cases are sporadic, but some are inherited in a dominant manner. And Huntington's disease is the exception here because it is always inherited, whereas chronic traumatic encephalopathy, one believes, is probably always environmentally induced. And close links exist between the causes of the inherited forms of disease and the events that cause inclusion formation. And one then extrapolates from these relatively rare familial forms of disease to the much more common sporadic ones. And if this extrapolation is correct to 100%, it would have to mean that the formation of these abnormal inclusions causes all forms of these diseases. And these inclusions are made of quite a small number of different proteins, which are known now, which have become known ever since about 1984. And it is clear that one protein, a given protein, can assemble into abnormal filaments in more than one disease. So 7 of the 13 diseases shown here, shown in blue, are so-called tauopathies. 3 of these diseases shown in red are synucleinopathies, and only Alzheimer's disease is characterized by the abnormal deposition of large amounts of beta amyloid, which is shown here in green. So Alzheimer's disease is different from the other conditions shown here in that you have two different filamentous inclusions. And I'll start with the tau. So I'll talk about filamentous inclusions of tau protein for most of the talk, but I also mention some work, ongoing work we've done on alpha-synuclein filaments and on beta-amyloid filaments. So in normal adult human brain, there are six tau isoforms that are expressed from a single gene through messenger RNA, alternative messenger RNA splicing. So this is the gene shown here schematically, and these are the six different tau isoforms. And they differ from each other by the presence of three inserts shown here in red, green, and yellow. I'm not going to say much more about the red and green inserts because they're probably not relevant directly for neurodegenerative diseases, but the yellow insert is quite important, and it encodes a 31 amino acid repeat. And depending on its presence or absence, one can divide the six tau isoforms into two groups. There are those which are four repeats each and those with three repeats each. And in normal adult human brain, the ratios between the three and the four repeat tau isoforms is roughly 1-to-1. And these repeats shown here, they form the microtubule binding domains of the tau protein. So the normal physiological function, if you like, as far as we understand it, of this protein is to bind to microtubules through this region here and to promote microtubule assembly as well as to bundle microtubules. Now, we believe that the diseases have nothing to do with the normal physiological function of the protein. So we do not believe that the diseases are caused by loss of function of this particular protein. We believe that the diseases are caused by a so-called gain of toxic function. And the gain of toxic function is probably the assembly of this protein into abnormal filaments. And the core of the filaments, I'm going to talk quite a bit about that later on. The core of the tau filaments is also made of this repeat region here, which would suggest that the normal physiological function of the protein and its pathological assembly are mutually exclusive phenomena. Now, if you look by light microscopy in human brain from these diseases, you find different types of tau inclusion. So these are different diseases stained with a tau antibody, and everything you see here is pathological, basically. So in Alzheimer's disease and tangle-only dementia, you have these sort of flame-shaped pyramidal cells. In Pick's disease, you have these sort of round inclusions, so-called Pick bodies, in this case, in granule cells of the hippocampus. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy, you have something that looks similar to Alzheimer's disease, but in contrast to Alzheimer's disease, many more glial cells are affected. And then you have progressive supranuclear palsy, corticobasal degeneration, where large numbers of glial cells have these filamentous tau inclusions in addition to many nerve cells. And you have argyrophilic grain disease, where you have these sort of characteristic little grains by light microscopy. So this is all light microscopy. If you now look by electron microscopy in these various diseases, invariably you find abnormal filaments. And these abnormal tau filaments, characteristic ones shown here, are in Alzheimer's disease. So they are the so-called paired helical filaments and the straight filaments. Some of the straight filaments are marked here by an S. Now, each tau filament is made of at least two parts, which you can sort of see here. There is a so-called core of the filament that I already mentioned, which is basically everything that's required for a filament to look like a filament under the electron microscope, and the so-called fuzzy coat, which is the rest of the tau molecule, which is a sort of dark black material, unstructured, lining the surface of the filaments. Now, if you look at different diseases and you look at which tau isoforms are present in the filamentous inclusions, you can divide tau diseases into three groups. All six thioester forms are found in these conditions here in the abnormal filaments, so in Alzheimer's disease, in familial British dementia, familial Danish dementia, primary age-related tauopathy, and chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Pick's disease, of all these conditions, is the only one where you only have three repeat tau isoforms in the filamentous inclusions. And then in corticobasal degeneration, in archaeophilic grain disease, age-related tau astrogliopathy, progressive supranuclear palsy, and globular glial tauopathy, you have only four repeat tau in the abnormal filamentous inclusions. And I'm going to mention the cryo-electron microscopy structures of tau filaments from all these conditions. But before doing so, I would like to put this sort of work into some sort of perspective. So the paired helical filaments of Alzheimer's disease, they were first described in 1963 by Michael Kidd in London. And he named them paired helical filaments because of their characteristic appearance under the electron microscope. In 1988, we showed that tau protein is an integral component of these filamentous inclusions. And at the time, we also suggested that the core of the tau filament is made of the repeat region and the fuzzy coat of the rest of the molecule. And then in 1991, Tony Crowther, here in the laboratory, he used electron microscopy and image reconstruction to show that paired helical filaments are made of two identical C-shaped protofilaments. So this would be one protofilament and this is the other one. So A, B, C, and A prime, B prime, C prime. But at the time, the resolution of these techniques was something like 20 angstroms, which meant that you could not see individual amino acids. And then in 2017, we reported the cryo-EM structure of the paired helical of the tau filaments from Alzheimer's disease at 3 angstrom resolution. And now you could see individual amino acids. But like Crowther, we found that the filaments are made of two identical C-shaped protofilaments. So this is one protofilament and this is another one. I'll come to which sorts of amino acids are present in these things. And this work and pretty much all the work that follows, really, I'm going to talk about, is done in close collaboration with Shores Sheres from the Structural Studies Division of the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology, where I work. So for the 441 amino acid isoform of tau, so that's the longest tau isoform present in the human brain, something like 18% of the molecule forms the core, but 82% forms the fuzzy coat. So the fuzzy coat is by far the largest part of the tau molecule. The core extends from residues 306 to 378 in this original description. We also looked at the straight filaments of Alzheimer's disease, and we determined the structures as well, and you can see here the paired helical filaments and the straight filaments. What is important to note here is that the protofilaments, so this is one protofilament, this is another one, here there's another one, and there's another one, that the protofilaments are identical between paired helical and straight filaments. There's always two, and they're exactly the same, but what distinguishes the paired helical from the straight filaments is the way the protofilaments are linked to each other. And we call this also ultrastructural polymorphs. So these two would be ultrastructural polymorphs, but they are made of one type of protofilament. That is different from some other diseases that I'm going to talk about a little bit later. Now, the next slide shows you the sort of higher resolution structure of the individual protofilament, and you can see that it extends from residues 273 or 304 to 380 in tau, which is basically the third repeat, the fourth repeat, and something like 12 amino acids after the fourth repeat. There are 8 beta strands in this structure, and they give rise to 2 anti-parallel beta sheets, and the other 3 beta strands, so beta 4, beta 5, and beta 6 give rise to a so-called beta helix. And I think this is still the only known molecule where you have beta sheets and beta helix in the same molecule. Now, over the past year or so, we have learned that the Alzheimer's, what we call the Alzheimer fold of assembled tau, is not unique to Alzheimer's disease. We also find it in posterior cortical atrophy. One could say that's a subtype of Alzheimer's disease. But then you also find it in some prion protein amyloidosis. So this is sort of Viennese connection, I guess. Gerstmann-Streusler-Scheinker syndrome. You find the tau fold when you have tau inclusions in this condition. You also find it in familial British dementia and familial Danish dementia. And in all these conditions, you have extracellular deposits. In Alzheimer's disease, they are made of beta amyloid. In prion protein amyloidosis, of prion protein. In familial British and Danish dementias, of this protein called BRI. So whenever it looks like that, whenever you have extracellular deposits, the intraneuronal tau inclusions that you find in structurally are of the Alzheimer type. However, we also find this Alzheimer fold in primary age-related tauopathy. And by definition, primary age-related tauopathy does not have any extracellular deposits. And that therefore must mean, I think, that this structure can form in the absence of extracellular deposits, but perhaps once it has formed, you can produce larger amounts of it through these extracellular deposits. So the extracellular deposits would promote perhaps the formation of these inclusions, but they would not induce their formation. And the next slide shows you where in the tau sequence this core is. So as already said, the core contains the whole of the third repeat, the whole of the fourth repeat, and something like 12 amino acids after the fourth repeat. It also contains the extreme C termini of repeats 1 and 2. And the fact that they are present, I think, explains why all 6 tau isoforms are found in the Alzheimer fold. The exact amino terminus of this fold, we don't really know. So it could be that there are a few more amino acids here that are present in the core of the filaments. But what is very clear is that the amino terminus of repeats 1 and 2 is not present in the core of the filaments. So this is Alzheimer's disease. We then went and looked at another condition, which is sort of, well, in some quarters at least, is sort of a high profile condition, and that this is chronic traumatic encephalopathy. So it is associated with repetitive head impacts or exposure to blast waves. And it was first described as the punch drunk syndrome and dementia pugilistica in retired boxers. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy has since been identified in former participants of other contact sports, in ex-military personnel, and also after domestic abuse. And it is defined by an abundance of hyperphosphorylated tau in neurons, astrocytes, and cell processes around blood vessels. So this is, repeated blows to the head, I guess, and could argue is about the most non-specific injury you can have. And yet it leads to a pathology that's actually quite sort of precise and sophisticated. And so 3 years ago, so we determined the structures of tau filaments from the brains of 2 ex-boxers and 1 former American football player, with CTE clinically. And the filament structures were identical in all 3 cases, but they were distinct from those of Alzheimer's disease, which came as a bit of a surprise. So you can see that the folds here are similar, but they're not identical to those of Alzheimer's disease. Like in Alzheimer's disease, you have 1 protofilament that can give rise to 2 different filaments, which we call CTE type 1 and type 2 filaments, which are again ultrastructural polymorphs. but they are different at an individual protofilament is different from that in Alzheimer's disease. And the most striking difference is the presence of this density here, which is in the beta helix region. There's an internal density. We don't know at present what this density is made of, but it's clearly not made of tau. You know, one possibility is that it's, I don't know, some sort of small lipid or something, and it could in principle mean that the formation of this particular fold has to do could be initiated, let's say, by this entity which we do not know at the moment. And this is present because, or can be present because, the beta helix region in the chronic traumatic encephalopathy fold is wider than in the Alzheimer fold. The next slide shows you the protofilament sequence again of the CTE fold, and you can see that in this region here it's very, very similar, almost identical to the Alzheimer fold, but in here it's quite different. And this is this thing indicates the so-called cofactor. The next slide compares the CTE and Alzheimer tau filament fold. So it's CTE here, Alzheimer here, and then you overlay the two, and you can see that they overlay very well in this region here, but not in that region there. And we're trying at the moment to find out what this density may be made of. And as you'll see in later examples, there are also other densities in other conditions. So this is CTE and Alzheimer's disease. So these are the two folds that we have, where you have all six tau isoforms in the filaments. I now turn to Pick's disease, where you only have three repeat tau in the filaments. And in Pick's disease, we find two types of filaments, which we call the narrow and the wide Pick filaments. The wide Pick filament is basically two of the narrow ones put together. And if you just look at the shape of this, you can see that the shape is very different from what you had in Alzheimer's disease and in CTE, which proves basically that you can have different conformers of assembled tau in these different diseases. This shows you the higher the sort of amino acid sequence of the Pick fold. It now contains 9 beta strands, and they give rise to 4 anti-parallel beta sheets. There's no beta helix, and the 9th beta strand here packs on the other side of the eighth beta strand. Now, the next slide shows you another disease, which is cortical basal degeneration. So this is now a disease where you only have 4 repeat tau in the filamentous inclusions, and in cortical basal degeneration, we find that the core of the filament contains the whole of the second repeat, the whole of the third repeat, the whole of the fourth repeat, and about 12 amino acids after the fourth repeat. And this is different from Pick's disease, where the second repeat was missing, because Pick's disease is a disease where you only have 3 repeat tau in the filamentous inclusions. So in cortical basal degeneration, then we find that the core extends from lysine residue 274, which you can see here, to glutamic acid residue 380. And the core structure of these filaments adopts a previously unknown 4-layered fold. So this is 1, 2, 3, and 4. Four different layers. And here as well, you have a large non-proteinaceous entity of which unknown identity at the moment that is present here. We believe that this is probably hydrophilic because it abuts onto charged amino acids, lysines and glutamic acids, but we don't really know what it is. And we find either single protofilaments, or this sort of singlets or doublets, in cortical basal degeneration. So that's different from Alzheimer's disease, where you had only doublets. Here you can have singlets or doublets, and in Pick's disease as well, you could have singlets or doublets, but in Pick's disease, the singlet was the predominant species, whereas here the doublet tends to be the predominant species. Now this shows you the CBD fold at higher magnification, well, at sort of single atomic level, and you can see the 4 different layers, and you can see the non-proteinaceous density here. We then looked at a whole host of other diseases where you have tau pathology that is made of only 4-repeat tau. And we to our surprise, we found that, for instance, archaeophilic brain disease, which you have here, is also characterized by a four-layered fold. So it's very clear that structurally archaeophilic brain disease and cortical basal degeneration would fit into the same category. So this fold is not identical to the cortical basal degeneration one, but it's similar. And we find a fold that is identical to this one in age-related tau astrogliopathy, as well as in some cases where you have mutations in the tau gene in intron 10 at positions plus 3 and plus plus 16. Now, this sort of defines then a sort of class of tau diseases which are characterized structurally by this four layered fold, and that is very different from what we saw in for instance progressive supranuclear palsy, which is probably the most common tau disease without any extracellular deposits. Now the core of the filament here again extends from glycine residue 272 to asparagine 381, so it's almost the same amino acid sequence as in CBD, and yet the structure of the fold is completely different. So this is now a three-layered fold, so it's 1, 2, and 3, and we found this in every single case of progressive supranuclear palsy we looked at, except one that I'll come to in a minute. So even in cases that are, you know, called a Richardson syndrome or the Parkinsonian forms or the cortical basal forms, they all had this same PSP fold. Now, here as well as in CBD and also in CTE, you have some sort of densities that probably correspond to what we call associated molecules or cofactors that may play a role in the assembly of the protein into this fold, but we don't know at present what these things are made of. Another condition we looked at is globular glial tauopathy, which is another disease with 4-repeat tau inclusions, and it is divided into 3 different types. And we looked in types 1 and 2, we also found a three-layered fold. We could not determine the structures of filaments from type 3 because the filaments are too straight. But it would suggest, I think, that type 3 of globular glial tauopathy is probably a completely different disease. It is probably not, should not be called globular glial tauopathy. Now, as I mentioned, there was one case of progressive supranuclear palsy that was different. And that case, had been clinically diagnosed as progressive supranuclear palsy, neuropathologically as well. But when we determined the structures of the filaments, the structures were different, and they were somewhere in between the globular glial tauopathy and the progressive supranuclear palsy fold. So we call this the globular glial tauopathy progressive supranuclear palsy tau or GPT fold. I'm not going to go into the details of this. It's a three-layered fold, but it is different from the other two. Histologically, then, after we found this, the neuropathologists went back to this case, and lo and behold, they found something that is atypical of progressive supranuclear palsy, which is large amounts of 4-repeat tau inclusions in limbic areas. So we call this clinical condition limbic predominant neuronal inclusion body 4-repeat tauopathy, or LNT. And I think this work shows that using cryo-electron microscopy, it is possible to discover probably new disease entities. Now, all this work then led us to a hierarchical classification of tauopathies based on the structures of the filament cores, and these sort of structure-based classification, we believe, complements clinical diagnosis and neuropathology, and as I mentioned just now, it allows identification of new disease entities. So filaments from all tauopathies studied so far, so everything that you see here, irrespective of what they look like, comprise the third repeat and the fourth repeat and 10 to 12 amino acids after the fourth repeat in tau. Diseases where you basically only have this particular part of the tau sequence in the core are these ones here, where you have all six tau isoforms. So it's Alzheimer's disease, familial British dementia, familial Danish dementia, primary age-related tauopathy. And then you can just separate this into two parts because the chronic traumatic encephalopathy fault is different from these ones shown here. Pick's disease is the only three-repeat tau disease in this condition. And again, you can look at the shape of this versus that. You can see it's completely different. And then we have the four-repeat tau diseases, and they fall into two large groups based on whether they are four-layered faults or three-layered faults. The four-layered faults would be cortical basal degeneration, archaeophilic grain disease, these intronic mutations here, and RTAG. Three-layered fault would be progressive supranuclear palsy, globular glial tauopathy, and the GPT fold. Now, there are additional differences at individual amino acid levels I'm not going to go into, which makes that this is different fold-wise from that, and the same here. And we keep working on additional conditions to try and find to sort of refine this this classification. So this brings me to one question that people sometimes ask, which is the question of what we mean by a conformer of assembled tau or any other sort of assembled protein associated with neurodegenerative diseases. So we would argue that a conformer is defined as having a specific structure of the ordered filament core. So the Alzheimer fold is different from the PSP fold, for instance. So they will be different molecular conformers of assembled tau. We find that each tauopathy is characterized by its own filament conformation, but that some tauopathies share the same conformation. So you have, for instance, I showed archaeophilic grain disease and these intron 10 mutation cases, they have the same conformation. So these would be examples of tauopathies sharing the same conformation. But what we find is that differences in conformation are always between some diseases. They're never between individuals with a given disease. So if you look at, say 10 or 20 cases of Alzheimer's disease, probably what we've done roughly so far, the structures of the tau filaments are identical between these cases. But if you look at so far 10 cases of PSP, they are all the same for those PSP cases, but they're different from the Alzheimer's case. And I think this sort of, there are sort of exceptions to some extent, but overall, I think this provides a good, it's surprising in a way. It shows that clinical diagnosis is probably pretty good in delineating disease entities. So what all this is sort of, it's sort of okay, but somebody could say, well, so what, it's all very descriptive stuff. It's end stage disease. It doesn't really tell you what's going on in the early stages. And in order to be able to study this in future, so basically study the mechanisms that lead to filament assembly in different human diseases, one needs to develop methods by which to form tau filaments that have the same structures as those from human brain. And 3 years ago, so I'm not showing this, but we showed that structures of heparin-induced tau filaments, adding heparin to recombinant tau is a common way to produce tau filaments. The structures of those filaments differed from those found in human disease. And in recent work, Sophia Loverstam has been able to form tau filaments from recombinant protein, but so far only from truncated tau, so 297 to 391. These protein assembles into filaments in the absence of any heparin or any extracellular factor, and the structures of those filaments are identical to the paired helical filaments. And what was surprising in a way was that when she did these experiments, she used the same constructs, but now she added 200 millimolar sodium chloride in this case to the incubation reaction. She did not form paired helical filaments anymore, but now she formed chronic traumatic encephalopathy type 2 filaments, including these sort of mysterious density in the in the beta helix region. And so I think this type of work shows that in principle it should be possible to understand a bit more about mechanisms of of filament formation and neurodegeneration using these types of techniques. But so far we have been unsuccessful in being able to form tau filaments like those found in say Pick's disease or corticobasal degeneration and any of these conditions. So this is all I was going to say about tau. I just want to briefly mention alpha-synuclein and then beta amyloid. And I want to end up with a recent work that's it was published only last month about a type of filament that we find, which is made of this protein called transmembrane protein 106B. And which is found in a very large number of different conditions. So, in principle, what we have done for tau filaments can also be done for filaments associated with other diseases. And so, 2 years ago, we reported the structures of alpha-synuclein filaments from multiple system atrophy brains. I'm not going to go into the details of this, but we found two types of filaments. Each filament, it consists of two protofilaments, and here now the protofilaments are different from each other. So you have a total of four different protofilaments here. This shows you another version of these two types of filaments. And what is important to note here is that between the two protofilaments, you have this sort of, again, a density of unknown identity that may play an important role in the assembly of this material. Now, multiple system atrophy is one of the three major diseases with alpha-synuclein filamentous inclusions. The others are Parkinson's disease and dementia with Lewy bodies. And so the question is, what are the structures of alpha-synuclein filaments in these conditions? At the moment, we don't know, but this is something we are working on quite heavily. The reason why we don't know is because we find that in Parkinson's disease, dementia with Lewy bodies, the filaments are much straighter than in multiple system atrophy, which makes it technically much more difficult to get their sort of near atomic structures. But one thing that we did show already 2 years ago was that when we look in dementia with Lewy body brains by a technique called two-dimensional class averaging, so this is not a three-dimensional near atomic structure, but this is sort of an indication of similarities and differences, we find that the two-dimensional class averaging that we get for dementia with Lewy bodies are different from those of multiple system atrophy, which I think probably indicates that the structures in the end will be different, so that there would also be different conformers of assembled alpha-synuclein. And we are working quite hard at the moment to try and get the near atomic structures of these filaments from Parkinson's disease and dementia with Lewy bodies. And I think probably in another couple of months, we'll probably have them. What we can already say is that they're almost certainly going to be different structurally from what we saw in multiple system atrophy. So this is alpha-synuclein. And then another condition is that, if you look at the literature, what you often find is that that people, especially people using solid-state NMR, so nuclear magnetic resonance, in order to do that, you need very large amounts of filaments. So what they tend to do is they use seeds from human brain, and then they amplify the material using recombinant protein. And the assumption, there's a hidden assumption in all this work, and the hidden assumption is that the structures of the seeds will be the same as those of the seeded assemblies. And we did some work on this last year, and we showed that certainly under these conditions, this is not true. So if you can use seeds from multiple system atrophy cases of, where we have a structure, and you do a amplification of this material, and you get filamentous structures out, but the structures of those filaments are not the same as those of the seed. So I think this shows that it's a sort of caveat to many of these experiments. Now, in January of this year, We also reported the structures of beta amyloid 42 filaments from Alzheimer's disease brain, but also from the brains of a whole host of other conditions. We found type 1, type 1b, and type 2 amyloid beta filaments. These left-handed filaments have quite different structures from those of the right-handed A-beta 40 filaments that were determined previously using cryo-electron microscopy by Markus Fendrich and colleagues in Germany, in their case from blood vessel deposits of Alzheimer's disease, whereas this is from basically from plaques of Alzheimer's disease. Now, we find that in sporadic cases of Alzheimer's disease, so these cases here, we have a predominance of what we call type 1 filaments, whereas in familial cases of Alzheimer's disease, which are those here, but the N number is small, it's only two cases so far, one with an amyloid precursor protein gene mutation, one with a presenilin 1 gene mutation, we have at what we call type 2 filaments. But then, which suggested that, you know, initially we thought this shows perhaps that sporadic and familial Alzheimer's disease are different diseases. But then when we looked at these conditions here, where beta amyloid deposits are a co-pathology, so for instance, in ARTAG, Parkinson's disease dementia, dementia with Lewy bodies, frontotemporal dementia case, and something called pathological aging. Pathological aging, you have lots of beta amyloid deposits in the brain, but no tau inclusions and no cognitive impairment. But in all these conditions, we find predominance of type 2 filaments, like we find in familial Alzheimer's disease, but not in sporadic ones. So I don't think that's the explanation. We at the moment, we don't really know why you have these two different types. We also had a mouse, so this is a knock-in mouse, the so-called APP-NLF mouse line. So this is a mouse line that has lots of extracellular deposits of wild-type human A-beta 42. And here as well, we find the type 2 filaments in 100%. 100% of filaments are type 2 filaments, which I think is the first example of an animal model where you reproduce the structures of the of disease filaments that one finds in human brain. Now this shows you the differences between the type 1 and the type 2 filaments. So you can see that type 1 goes, I think it's from residue 9 to 42, and this type 2 goes from residue 12 to 42 of beta amyloid. So the fuzzy code here is this sequence here. So it's very small, so it's about 20% of the of this material is the fuzzy code, 80% is the core. It's almost the opposite of what we had for tau earlier. You always have two protofilaments, but the two identical protofilaments, but the protofilaments individually differ between these two types. So that's again different from what we had for tau earlier on. Now, this is sort of, you know, we don't really know at this point what the difference is between these two types, why you get one type preferentially over another type. One possibility is that it has to do with the length of disease, so the length of the pathological process, so that when there's a relatively short period of time, you tend to have a predominance of type 2. When it's a very long period of time, you have a predominance of type 1. It's also not clear whether one type can sort of transform into another. All this remains to be seen. And so I do want just to turn very briefly to this more recent work. So whereas tau alpha-synuclein and A-beta deposits are associated with specific neurodegenerative diseases, so you have A-beta deposits in 100% of cases with Alzheimer's disease, let's say, and not in 100% of cases with other conditions. And you do not have A-beta deposits in large amounts in, let's say, Parkinson's disease or in multiple system atrophy. We found recently that a class of previously unknown filaments, so they had never been described before, are found in many different neurodegenerative diseases. So we find them in pretty much every single type of neurodegenerative disease. And they are made of this protein here, which is transmembrane protein 106B, or part of this protein. I'll come to that in the next slide. We find three different folds, but we also find some of these folds in people as a function of age. So these are so-called neurologically normal people who have some of these filamentous deposits in their brains, but they have no symptoms of any sort. Now, what is this TMEM106B? Well, here you have the normal proteins, and it's an alpha fold prediction of this normal protein. It is 274 amino acids in length, and it consists of an intracytoplasmic domain, which is this here, a transmembrane domain here, and then a lysosomal domain. So it's inside, this part is inside lysosomes, and this is structured. So it forms an immunoglobulin-like fold, and it is residues 120 to 274 that assemble into this filament. So we believe that it requires cleavage at residue, just before serine residue 120, as soon as that cleavage has happened, these filaments form. But as I said, we don't know what their relevance is for a neurodegenerative process. This is a Western blot using an antibody that we made that is specific for this TMEM106B intralysosomal region, and you can see that these are so-called neurologically normal people, all of them, and you can see that as a function of age, these 29 kilodalton band starts appearing. We also find it in many different conditions, you know, where people have neurodegenerative diseases. And this slide here shows you the immunostaining using the same antibody in human brain section. So this is, I think, from a 20-year-old. This is one of the people, the 84-year-old that we determined the structure of filaments from. And you can see nothing, basically nothing here, but here you can see inclusions, and this shows you a higher magnification of these inclusions. And so at present, we don't really know what this means in terms of neurodegenerative disease, but I think this work shows that you can identify, using these cryo-electron microscopy techniques, you can identify previously unknown filamentous inclusions. You know, if you think about the plaques and tangles of Alzheimer's disease, they were described over 100 years ago, and the filaments have been known since the 1960s, and yet this was completely missed until this point. And this brings me to the end of my talk. So it remains to me to thank my colleagues at the MRC, Laboratory of Molecular Biology, so this stands for Medical Research Council, and a large number of collaborators in many different parts of the world. But in particular, I would like to thank Shores Sheres, with whom all this cryo-electron microscopy work has been done in collaboration with. And I thank you for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Professor, this was a really exciting tour de force.
Thank you.
To a very, very new topic for a clinician. Exciting that these structures are of isometric kind of asymmetric kind of positioning. So really fascinating. We got a couple of questions and time has gone, so I would start with the questions. The first one is, do you see differences in tau structure in different brain regions that represent the march of the disease through the brain a la Bragg data?
Yes. So we looked, obviously, a caveat in all this work is that the N numbers are relatively small because it's a huge amount of work just to do one case. But we looked in different brain regions in some cases, and we have never see any differences. So for instance, I think one of the cases we looked at of primary age-related tauopathy had a Bragg stage of, I think, 2. So it's largely, you know, entorhinal cortex, and the structure of the filaments, the structures were identical to those we find in frontal cortex in Braak stages 5 and 6. We also, you know, if you look at posterior cortical atrophy, which by definition has large numbers of these tau inclusions in the occipital cortex, and we compare the structures to the frontal cortex, in those cases, again, they were identical. We do find, though, very rarely, but we do find cases where we have more than one fold in a particular brain region. So we had one case of PSP, for instance, where we had the PSP fold in the entorhinal cortex, but in the entorhinal cortex, we also had the AGD fold. But in the thalamus of that case, we only had the PSP fold. What we believe that this indicates is that this person had two diseases. So the person had PSP and archaeophilic brain disease. We've never found cases where you had in different brain regions of the same individual with a given disease, you had different structures. So I think probably what all this indicates is that the disease process starts locally. And once you have the fold formed, it's relatively straightforward for the same fold to spread through the brain. But the thing that's determining is probably the particular brain region, particular cell types where it forms initially, and then it's sort of rigid and then stuck until the end.
So you think that this targets specific cells, because this is something really wondering why that here, why that other there?
Yes.
PSP, for instance, or these things that are targeting very specific brain regions.
I think that's the most likely explanation. Yes. It could even be that the disease, let's say in PSP or in CBD, that the disease process starts in a particular brain region, but not in nerve cells, but in glial cells, for instance. And it is true that once the fold has formed through seeded aggregation, you can perpetuate the same fold. The thing, I mean, it's this question of the first event. I mean, it's probably, I don't know, it might be impossible ever to get to the first event because it's clinically totally silent. But I think all this, I mean, it's indirect, but I think this supports the idea of the so-called prion-like spreading of filamentous aggregates through the brain over time.
Yeah.
Are there tauopathies that are completely asymptomatic?
Well, it's a question of, you know, it's a question of quantity. It's not a question of quality. So everybody in, pretty much everybody, the general population over the age of 60, let's say, will have some tau inclusions in the entorhinal cortex. Structurally, these inclusions will be identical to what you have in full-blown Alzheimer's disease, but the numbers in the brain would be much, much smaller. So I think it's probably, once you have a certain level of pathology, symptoms will start to appear. So it's a question whether you want to call these things tauopathies. So you have this thing called primary age-related tauopathy, you know, which in most people produces absolutely no symptoms. And then for beta amyloid, you have this thing called pathological aging, where people have lots of beta amyloid deposits, but again, clinically, they are completely asymptomatic. So I think it's a question of amounts, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always a continuum. It's not really what they normally do. We put it into boxes or into cupboards, but in a matter of fact, it's a continuum. And also the one case you showed with two different diseases, rare diseases, in one person is one of those things as well. So the question is
what is and the other thing, I guess, is that.
Go on.
I just wanted to say that it all, you know, if you take something like archaeophilic brain disease, in the entorhinal cortex, for instance, it's very easy to recognize it. The grains, you know, histologically, but if you look in the cerebral cortex, I'm not sure that there is anything like grains. And yet, you could have the same audiophilic brain disease fold in both the entorhinal cortex and the cerebral cortex. So I think the evidence so far suggests that this fold stuff is, it's in a way, it's more fundamental than the histology is. And the histology is probably more fundamental than the clinical picture is. So I think this sort of, in principle, we allow it to refine the diagnostic criteria in the end. Of course, we'll go overboard and not to just say, you know, whenever the structure is slightly different, it's by definition a different disease. So we have to be a bit careful that way. But I think it's true to say that the structural work is more, I think it's more rigor. I mean, it's not rigorous. It's more sophisticated or specific than I think even the histology is.
Which brings us to the next question, which goes in that direction. What is the biological significance of those 3D structures you solved? Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think the 3D structures, I mean, yeah, I mean, I this is my view, right? I mean, it's, I have no proof of this, but I think what is clear from what I said at the beginning is that the formation of these inclusions causes these diseases. So it causes the neurodegeneration associated with these diseases. And I think if when you look at, for instance, the PIC filament versus the Alzheimer filament, they are completely different in terms of their structures. And I think this means that they're chemically speaking, they're completely different ends. And I think you can easily imagine that the downstream effects of these things will be different. And so I think probably these different folds determine ultimately the clinical picture. So they tell you why Alzheimer's disease is different from PICC's disease or different from PSP, because people sometimes say, you know, one says there are all these diseases with tau inclusions. People say, well, you know, it's all very nice, but why are there different diseases? Why are they not all the same disease? Because they all have tau inclusions. And I think the reason is because, at least to some extent, between these diseases, the structures of the tau inclusions are different.
The next one from you. Yeah, the next one is a burning question for me, of course. As a clinician, I am always interested in early diagnosis. Do you think that we will be able to investigate on, for instance, cerebrospinal fluid and distinguish between those different diseases?
Yes. That I don't know. I think what will be, in principle at least, will become possible based on these differences is to develop ligands that are specific for some of these folds versus others. So it could increase the specificity, if you like, of the diagnosis, but perhaps also the sensitivity. CSF, I'm not so sure, because I think so far, for tau, for instance, what has been done in CSF is not assembled protein. It's a soluble protein, and it changes its levels. In Alzheimer's disease, for instance, it goes up. But then if you look in, let's say, progressive supranuclear palsy, we have lots of tau inclusions in the brain. In the CSF, you don't see much. So I think the CSF is probably, as far as the inclusions go, sort of marker at the moment. But it could be at the practical level, of course, it could be extremely valuable. So I think the most promising thing so far in all this is for diagnostics. One could also argue that therapeutics, it could be relevant, maybe it will be, but on the other hand, probably for therapeutics, what you would like to have is something that targets all these different folds, not just specific ones. Otherwise, you have to develop so many different therapies. But I think for diagnostics, it would be, it probably be important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, got another one. A-beta coexist with tau in neurodegenerative brain, or tau and A-beta comes from different region of the brains?
Yes. Yeah, so what I think, nobody really knows this whole business about, you know, there has to be some sort of connection between A-beta and tau, but nobody really understands it. But I think what the evidence suggests is that the tau inclusions form independently of the A-beta deposits. The A-beta deposits probably also form independently of the tau inclusions. And part of the reason is it temporally different, but also, as you said, they're different in terms of the brain regions where they first are encountered. But at some point, they're present in the same brain regions, and then perhaps the A-beta or the events leading to A-beta deposition drive the tau pathology. But then on the other hand, if you look at all these trials that have been done using antibodies against A-beta, they didn't work in Alzheimer's disease. They didn't work so well. And large part of the reason, I think, is because you have large amounts of tau inclusions, and probably at the end, towards the end stage, even if you remove all the beta amyloid that's there, you still are left with the tau inclusions. And it's the tau inclusions that probably cause the neurodegeneration more than the beta amyloid deposits. So it could be that if you could give these antibodies 20 or 30 years earlier, they might actually work very well. But then you would have to be able to identify people at risk of disease before they have symptoms of the disease. And I think that's probably the future. And I think that's where the PET ligands, for instance, come in. I think this is extremely important to have sensitive diagnostic criteria. But at the moment, that's way out of the question. I mean, you cannot do that. At an individual level, you cannot predict based on some marker like that whether somebody's going to get Alzheimer's disease 20 or 30 years later or not.
Yeah, this is exactly the clinical question, to define those people as soon as they are fell ill, as soon as they have symptoms. We know that we have 10, 20 years of anamnesis, and it might be nice to know it 10 years earlier and to have a disease then, and immunotherapy, whatever, to hinder the outbreak afterwards. Afterwards, we know we could yes. have had the possibility, but at the moment we don't have the possibility.
Yes. Another question right. is yes. concerning the CTE fold that you showed, the chronic encephalopathy.
Yes.
This is the mm-hmm. very only where you really know a cause.
Yes.
Or yes. repeated microtrauma.
Yes.
Why? Is this a complete difference, or don't we simply know the causes of the others?
Yeah, it's hard to say. So
it's obvious, weight. Yeah. And,
but I mean, what we find in general is that the, we find in CTE, we find the CTE fold. But we also find the CTE fold quite frequently now. In other diseases, and I would have thought that it's either it means that the CTE fold can form quite easily, even without severe head injury, or it may mean that there's more than one cause that can lead to the formation of the CTE fold. But you're right. I mean, that's the only condition of all these where we believe, right? We don't really know for sure either, but that it's entirely environmentally induced. Now, the other, and the fold is different from the Alzheimer fold, there's no doubt about that, but it's not that different, it's similar. And so one question would be, for instance, could something start as a CTE fold, then you lose, for some reason, you lose this density in the beta helix region, and then it turns into the Alzheimer fold, because head injury, for instance, is a risk factor for sporadic Alzheimer's disease. So there could be links that way, but there are, as far as I know, there are no familial forms of CTE. But it could be that head injury is necessary, or blast waves are necessary to produce CTE in the end, but they're not sufficient. So it could be that there's some people who are protected against it, even with a certain level of head injury. But what we know about the causes of the others, sporadic forms, I would say we don't know anything. much, except, you know, we know something about the familial forms, and we can find the causes of those familial forms, and from that we extrapolate to the sporadic forms. That extrapolation, I think, has to be allowed at some level, but the question is it allowed to 100%? If the extrapolation from the rare familial forms to the common sporadic ones is not allowed at all, I would argue that the whole field, everything, collapses intellectually. You know, everything, and I think that it's very, very, I think that's the big sort of thing we found in the last 40 years, is that there's a close connection between the causes of these rare familial forms of disease and the filament formation. That did not have to be the case. I mean, the causes of the familial cases could have been hundreds of steps away from the inclusion formation, but they're not. And I think that's a strong argument in favor of these studying these inclusions, but one has to be able to extrapolate, at least at some level, from the rare familial forms to sporadic ones.
Yeah, we find this in other neurodegenerative diseases as well, that we think, Parkinson's disease, for instance, that we think that two or three components have to get together. So somebody has a certain constellation of probably developing a neurodegenerative disease, and then you add the trauma, then you add the age, then you add some agents, whatever, and then the disease breaks out clinically.
Yeah, I think that's
only have the symptoms. Have the,
because I mean, you have coping. Yes, I mean, the familiar. Like, let's say Parkinson's disease. You have mutations in the alpha synuclein gene. They cause familial forms of Parkinson's disease. These at a relatively well at a younger age than most people have with the sporadic forms do. So you could argue that they are sort of a purer form in a way than the others. The others you need additional things like age and I don't know lifestyle or trauma or whatever. But I think these familial forms still tell you though one possible way you can get the disease. And so Then by definition, you know, if you look at the presence of Lewy bodies, Lewy neurons, the disease is defined that way. And you find that those in the sporadic forms of the disease and in the familial forms, where you know the cause, which is something that leads to Lewy body formation, you also find them. And that's then when you extrapolate. But you're right, I think that in the sporadic forms, more than one thing has to come together, and there could be multiple different ways by which you can form these Lewy bodies in the sporadic forms, and there may even be could be one pure way by which you form them in the familial forms. So it's tricky. There's also, I mean, this whole area which I think is sort of neglected often is of co-pathologies. So if you look in people who are old, let's say somebody with Parkinson's disease, you may find all sorts of other inclusions as well, perhaps at a lower level in those brains. And the question is, why do they form? You know, why, you know, and it could be that as the brain ages, all sorts of things go wrong, and that some and several proteins have a tendency to aggregate, and normally you would remove them through some sort of quality control mechanisms, and at some point in age the tendency to aggregate takes over, and then in the end you have multiple ones, whereas in the familial forms, because people are much younger, you have only one specific one. So I think that's but it's still, you know, it still means that the disease is defined. I mean, I think the picture is that if you take Parkinson's disease, over 95% of people who are clinically diagnosed as having Parkinson's disease have alpha-synuclein pathology in their brains. There are a few exceptions and stuff, but the vast, vast majority has them. So I think these definitions are I think they're okay. They're okay.
Yeah, they're quite accurate. Yeah. I have a final question. I do not get the sense, perhaps you get it.
Yes.
How do you think the identity of those non-protein components inside the fold of CBD, PSP, and other fibrils?
We don't know. I mean, we're trying to find out what they're made of, but unfortunately, it's a very difficult thing to do, because by cryo-electron microscopy, the filaments, that's the biggest reason, I think, is that the filaments are not pure. So you have all sorts of other things in there that are non-filamentous, so they don't really matter for the cryo-EM work, but they do matter when you do like mass spectrometry, for instance, and you get all sorts of things. So one thing we've been trying now for quite a while is to take the Alzheimer fold, which does not have this density on the inside, and the CDE fault, which does have it, they're otherwise quite similar, and to see what differences we can find between those by mass spectrometry. But so far, we haven't really been able to find any. It's very tricky. I mean, because you don't. I think one has to know what they are made of, and then one has to be able to study their role. It could be that their role is unimportant. It could be that they incorporate it after the assembly, but it could also be that their presence induces a particular assembly. But at the moment, I'm afraid, no idea.
Professor Goethe, many thanks for this fruitful discussion. I would like to hand back to Professor Alesh, because he has some final words, I suppose.
Yes. I'm very excited to have your hat here. I'm a bit, shamed that I forgot to introduce you adequately. British Medical Council. I did not know it. You explained it to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry that I did not mention it. I did even not mention that we both are Luxembourgians.
That's true.
Yes, the secret network of Luxembourg. Thank you very much for having been here. Thank you very much for this excellent presentation. It was a pleasure for us. And we are looking now forward for having the next Neurocast. This will be in 2 weeks, together with Thomas Brücke. We'll talk about the origins of levodopa therapy in Parkinson's disease, also in English. So you are kindly invited to attend this as well. Thank you very much. And when you stop here now, in 10 minutes.
Thank you very much for having me.
The presentation from Michel Goethe will be available online. So for those who didn't have the time to see it now, they can look it after. And it will be in the library of the Gesellschaft der Ärzte of the Medical Society of Vienna, the Billroth Society. And it will also be, it can also be seen there. Okay? Thank you.
And thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.